Good morning and welcome to the Philadelphia United Lodge of Theosophists. We are one of many such lodges situated around the world, each an independent, autonomous association of free thinkers and students of the philosophy of theosophy. Each lodge has one purpose, if you will, and that is to offer a center in which the fundamental principles of the philosophy of theosophy can be studied, discussed, comprehended as much as possible, and then taken out into daily life and applied in the art of living and the science of life. Those fundamental principles leave no time or space or, frankly, no interest of the association for any side issues. Rather, the focus is an understanding of the nature of man and the true meaning of universal brotherhood and the true application of universal brotherhood through altruistic efforts. And having said that, being there's no bylaws, there's no constitutions, all the efforts of any one of the independent lodges is put forth to keep the philosophy alive and well before the public mind and heart, and to welcome to its association all those who wish to serve humanity in the very broadest, most absolute sense, and therefore there's no admissions fees or costs, etc. So if you find the message of the philosophy to be something that has enlightened your life and lightened the load of the daily life for you, perhaps you'd like to consider to volunteer to join the Theosophical movement and to offer your services, whether that's time or energy, resources, cash, study habits, whatever it is, to enable yourself to be part of an association that truly is about fitting oneself to be the better able to serve, to help, and to teach others. In accordance with the Declaration, which is far more beautifully stated on the back of the periodical, this facility is open to the public on Sundays and Wednesdays every week and periodically on Friday evenings. This month, we are looking on Sundays at the issue of Theosophy and Symbols and Myths. Next Sunday, the door will open at 10:30 as it did this morning. And at 11 o'clock on Sunday, April 25th, a presentation will be given entitled The Allegories of Plato. And again, that will be the final consideration of Symbols and Myths this particular month. On Wednesdays, the door opens at 5:30. There is always an able student associate available to help anyone who wants to come in and research an individual line of study, or maybe prepare for a class or presentation, or maybe to follow an idea they've heard about and they're curious to know more about. This coming Wednesday is April 21st. The library will be open from 5:30 to 7:30, and at 7:45, a study class in the Ocean of Theosophy will commence, and that's a 7:30 to 9 p.m. study class. Slightly more informal than Sunday mornings, but certainly every bit as potent. Coming up in May, there are a couple of special dates, and again, they're a ways off yet, but you may want to note them on your calendar. Wednesday, May 5th, we will be commemorating the life and the achievements of H.P. Blavatsky in an annual event known as White Lotus Day. That will occur on a Wednesday night instead of the regular ocean class. And on the third Friday in May, May 21st, there will be the second of three presentations, a study of religions and philosophies, and those three monthly Fridays have been circling around the notion of the message of symbols. On Friday, May 25th, the building will open at 6:30, the class starts at 7, and the title for that night will be The Triangle and the Star. And again, those symbols will be looked at in the light of theosophy. Now this morning, We are offering a panel, which is the third for the month's theme of Theosophy and Symbols and Myths. And we are looking at the battles of the Ramayana and the Mahabharata, again, comparative religious philosophies in the light of theosophy. And what we're going to attempt to do is to give a general statement of the historical context and the plot lines of each. And then through the period of questions and answers and discussion, weave together what the symbolism of the myths are in the light of theosophy. The Ramayana is our starting point. It is a very, very, very ancient example of mythology and symbolism. The exoteric or the public historians would tell you that this is an oral tradition that is prehistoric and probably dates from 1500 before the Common Era. Theosophically, if you look into Isis and see what Isis has to say about the battle of the Ramayana, the battle is said to date to about 8,000 or maybe 7,500 BCE, with the eighth incarnation of Vishnu dated around 4,800 BCE. Be that as it may, that very early tradition known as the Ramayana starts out as a bardic, B-A-R-D-I-C, or epic tradition of oral tradition of history and mythology. There were many, many different early written versions. One that's very, very famous dates to about the year zero in our calendar time. The earliest renditions date to about the fourth century before Christ or before the Common Era. But it's the Valmiki poetic version that dates to about the time of the Christ, in which Rama is presented in Sanskrit and is presented as an incarnation of Vishnu, an epic hero who has come into the world to preserve moral order. And that particular rendition is absorbed into the Hindu Vishnu cult and was used starting about the fourth century and certainly by the beginning of the Common Era, especially by the upper castes and class in northern India, especially in politics, kind of like our Horatio Alger myth. Historically, it is echoed in Greece. Hellenistic Greece is that culture, of course, that goes from the Balkan Peninsula all the way over to the Indian subcontinent. And the story of Rama comes back into the Western world in the Homerian epic poems, the Iliad and the Odyssey, and you will recognize the storyline when you're thinking about Helen of Troy, certainly. There is a later 11th century in the Common Era a rendition called the Kamben epic version, and that one was written not in Sanskrit but in Tamil, which is the Dravidian language of southern India. And it remains a rendition that's the favorite of the southern Brahmins versus the Sanskrit version, which is the favorite of the northern Brahmins. Interestingly enough, in the mid-1970s, there is a very famous Indian author named Narayan, and in the 1970s, he said he felt compelled. He had this inner impulse, this drive, to write a popularized, retold Ramayana and Mahabharata. So you can find both of them in paperback by this individual who is retelling these ancient myths in English for the first time. These are extremely abridged, and his rendition of putting together a few different versions, but they're very, very popular, and they are definitely in line with the original story. Gandhi used the utopian image of the Ramayana when he was dealing with the indigenous Indians and trying to get India to be free and self-thinking. In 1988, there was a sanitation strike in northern India. Literally, the sanitation workers in a huge area went on strike because they felt that there were not enough episodes in the Ramayana on the TV. So before they'd go back to work, they demanded more episodes from the different versions of the Ramayana. And that tells you something about the amazing impact. The Diwali autumn festivals also feature the Ramayana. So what's the general plot line? Well, it's about ideals and the idyllic. It talks about the motives for battle. It talks about the motives for living. It's a series of studies in action and reaction. It's a study in how you detach from the motives of your actions to become more and more ethical. And the applications are sevenfold. It can be read esoterically in seven different ways. And you can use it for family life, among between parent and child, among and between siblings, or you can use it as lessons on a national order. Dasarathra is a compassionate and beloved king. He is the last of the solar dynasty, it is said. He has three wives and makes a deal with the gods so that each of the wives will bear him a son. He makes a sacred vow and carries through with that, and lo and behold, comes up with four sons, the eldest of which is Rama. The true heir to the throne is Superman, and in the TV episodes, kind of like the Rambo of India from Bollywood, Rama is a character who is indeed can be studied as a youth, a disciple, a brother, a lover, an aesthetic, a warrior. He wins the virtuous bride named Sita, and ultimately speaking, he remains obedient. His father makes a vow to the second wife. Bharata is his half-brother, and instead of Rama being given the throne, he is banished for 14 years. Bharata comes forward and takes the throne for 14 years, and the adventures are on. Rama leaves the kingdom for the 14-year banishment to be obedient and to honor the vows that his father has taken. He leaves with his third brother, Lakshmana, who is a twin, and they go off into the forest where there is a period of trials. Sorpanaka is a sorceress who tries to woo Rama, only to be disfigured by his brother. Her brother enters the scene and kidnaps the beautiful Princess Sita, and Rama then takes steps to, with his half-brother, to try to get his bride back away from the evil sorcerer, Ravana. Ultimately, there are battles on an island called Lanka, and the battles involve flying monkeys and giants and these children of the solar dynasty. And ultimately speaking, there are ethical crises for Rama on that island, both involving his wife and what he does with an absent-minded or mindless act. Ultimately, at the end of the modern retelling, the groom and the wife are reunited and return just in time to take their rightful places as the dynastic.
Well, you will hear themes repeated in the Mahabharata from what you just heard. Consider these words, perhaps they were Arjuna's at one time. Karma disdains to fight except alone. He wears a cape fastened at his shoulder by a round clasp. He looks at me with hard eyes, but if love has any cause, he is my ancient friend from another life, angry at me after a little quarrel. The ways of Dharma are subtle and hard to find. After this, I am still alive. I think I have no death. So we are engaged now in the story, another epic story, forgive our allergies this morning, of the Mahabharata, the great house of Bharat, the history, basically, of India. Equally, the popular notion of the age of this story is 2,000 years. In the Secret Doctrine, HPB says it's closer to 1,500, 1,600 now maybe. So it's in that range, but certainly the Ramayana preceding this. It is epic is not the word to describe it. It is 18 books long. They say it is 8 times longer than the Iliad and the Odyssey put together. So obviously we did not have time to read it all. We'll give you some highlights. So there are a number of crucial pieces to the story, but basically it begins with the ancestors of the Bharat or Bharata family. And in the telling of the story, it weaves in equally celestial beings and vows being made, in this case, vows being broken and honored both. But starts with a story of Santanu, king of Hastinapura, forgive the pronunciation, married to the beautiful Ganga, who was the river goddess in disguise. And every time she was pregnant and bore a child, she would immediately throw the child into the river to drown. Now, before being married, the husband had taken a vow never to question anything she would do. This was his solemn vow, and he lived up to it up until the seventh time this happened. And he questioned and couldn't understand. And her response was that these were children who were gods, and their karma, in essence, was to be among men, and she was saving them that terrible experience by drowning them. The eighth child, however, lived. This child would be the forebear of this family of Bharat. And it tells us early on the importance and power of vows are evident throughout the epic. Once stated, a vow becomes truth and must be fulfilled no matter what else may happen. So we go through many incarnations of relatives being born and vows being made and broken. Basically, we're looking at the family of the Pandavas, or we hear in the Gita the Pandu as an abbreviated. We won't go into the details, there's too much of it, but the ruler, the first ruler in the house was Dhritarashtra, who was, I'm sorry. Thank you. That. He was physically blind, and it is said he's a weak ruler and allows his blindness to become a refusal to face reality and unwilling to confront hard decisions that he would have to make, saying, "O king, surely a man who meets with calamity as a result of his own acts should not blame the gods, destiny, or others. Each of us receives the just results of our actions." So wound in with these tales of failure are the ideas that if we look at this as karma, as just result, then there can be no disappointment. We need to do our dharma, our duty. And it's given the idea of the dharma of fire is to burn. So it is the natural duty of the ones involved. Along the way, Arjuna is born. He becomes a master of the bow. He is trained by wise ones. And it says a stranger appears who challenges Arjuna and equals him in archery. This is Karna, who the reader learns is Kunti's first son by Surya, the sun god, etc., etc. So there is a great, the first smaller battle would be the archery contest. And of course, Arjuna wins and has the hand of the beautiful princess. And there is, there are, sorry, we're getting lost. So there is tension. There's a group of cousins who are rivals for this land and for the kingship. And there's tension mounting. And at this point in the story, Krishna makes his appearance. It is said he may be the incarnation of the god Vishnu, the preserver, come down to save the earth from chaos. This is a major theme throughout, that whenever there is difficulty and the kingdom is about to go to ruins, a savior appears on the scene. Sounds familiar to us, doesn't it? So there is a game of dice, and this is where we're getting up to the beginning of the Bhagavad Gita. There's a game of dice, and the ruler at that time was known to have a weakness for games of chance. So he is enticed into this game, continues to lose. Every time the dice is thrown, he bets some more and continues to lose. And eventually, him and his kin are exiled as a result of the failure of this game of chance. Similarly to the 14 years, there's a 12-year exile with a 13th year to be held in disguise, never to be known as this royal family, rather to go and experience the world as a common man. All during this time, war is approaching. The Pandava family and the Kurava family are again fighting over the same rulership, the land. The time for the battle arrives. The family that was in exile returns for the battle. The one side believes they broke the vow by returning. They believe they fulfilled the time of the vow. So they return, enter the Bhagavad Gita. The 18-day war between the two sides, the Pandus and the Kurus. Both sides, it is said, agree to abide by certain rules of war. No fighting humans with celestial weapons, which they had. No fighting at night. No striking someone who's retreating or unarmed. And all of these rules, it is said, will eventually be broken. So again, a vow is made and it is not fulfilled. As the battle is about to start, we know Arjuna falters, and we forgot one important part. At the beginning of the preparation for the battle, the choice is given. Arjuna can have the army for himself or Krishna, the charioteer. And of course, we all know he chose Krishna, who was to be his guide, taking the guise of his higher self, giving him advice. So we're familiar with that story. Those on all sides of the war die except the five Pandavas. And it is said by, we won't pronounce the name, we the conquerors have been conquered, because at the end of the battle they realize all that has been given up in this effort. 36 years pass, and say it for me again. Yudhisthira. Oh, okay. 36 years pass, and this soul arrives at the entrance to paradise. All the family have died, have perished. He arrives at the gates to paradise carrying a dog in his arms. His brothers and all have left the earth. They have fallen from the mountains into the abyss, it is said, along the way. So he expects them in hell. A gatekeeper tells him to abandon the dog if he wants to enter paradise, which he refuses to do because the animal was his companion, his friend, and one with whom he feels a connection in life, that this creature is worthy of this reward as well. This was to be a test for him. The dog, it is said, was the god Dharma in disguise. This was a test for him. So he is able to enter paradise. His enemies are there, smiling and contented. His brothers, on the other hand, seem to be in a place of suffering and torment. He can't rightly stay in paradise while his family is suffering. So he forsakes paradise to come back to the land of suffering. And that was the final test. All are given the final reward of what we might call enlightenment. And in notes on the Gita by Subha Rao, there's a beautiful sentence we wanted to read. Whenever any particular individual reaches the highest state of spiritual culture, develops in himself all the virtues that alone entitle him to a union with the Logos, and finally unites his soul with it, there is, as it were, a sort of reaction emanating from that Logos for the good of humanity. So ultimately, we see in both stories God's becoming human. We see the power of a vow. There is a time in the life of those where there is a separation from the general affairs of men, or what we might consider a period of learning detachment, as was mentioned. There's contemplation. During that time, there is the assimilation of the lessons to be learned, a recognition of duty, which we think is one of the key ideas. And finally, in the coming back to fulfill that Dharma, there is a sense of enlightenment that the responsibility for the good of all has been undertaken willingly. And so we think this is the story of all of us, and it occurs time and again under different periods, under different names and stories, but it is the eternal myth of the pilgrim's journey, as we all are.
As my partner spoke, something else came to mind. The issue of archery also focuses in the Ramayana, in that when Rama is undergoing initiation and is getting ready to choose a bride, he earns her as such with this tremendous strength, with his ability as a bowman to be able to shoot an arrow a particular distance, to have it hit its mark in a precise way. And in fact, he's so strong that he breaks that bow. And a great deal is made out of that. And then later in the story, when he has his mindless moment and he does do something that's karmically just not up to snuff, it's involving that bow and arrow, in which he kills one of the innocent monkeys and then goes through an entire transition of learning after he has slain an ally by mistake, by not being mindful in the moment. And the other thing that tickled my fancy is the next first Sunday, when you're enjoying brunch upstairs, take a good look at the photographs on the side wall in the upstairs library. There's a picture of Mr. Judge, isn't there? With a bow and an arrow. Yeah.
Certainly, and it's a wonderful correspondence to concentration, one-pointedness, keeping our eye on the target. We think there's so many lessons in these stories. Mm-hmm. So your thoughts and questions? Yes.
So just like at the symposium yesterday, we were talking about how so many of these monoliths and structures were used almost like to hide the real teachings, you know, for posterity. So are these a verbal type of structure then that's using the teachings to that they're being hidden as well?
In terms of the Ramayana, for sure that would be the case. You can go through Isis and research ape or monkey. And you begin to wonder, you know, what is this about an army of flying monkeys who ally themselves with the solar king to fight the lunar king, Ravana, out on this island, ostensibly over a bride and the misapplication of marriage vows. But when we think about it, we've got the imagery of water. They're traveling across the seas. And again, water can be the source of life. It can be the symbol for wisdom. And we've seen some of those details in the bas-reliefs and the monuments with the little zigzags, which definitely connotes water. But in this case also, if we stop and think about this, there's embedded in this adventuresome tale a historical reality that there was a tremendous flooding, that a particular island, now known as Sri Lanka, if you will, was isolated, and you have the interplay of Atlanteans fighting off Aryans, and the transition from one root race to another with all of that graduation. Remember, we're told over and over again that the different rounders can coexist for a time. There's a transition. It's not, you know, you flip a switch and that line goes away and a new line comes. No, they overlap. So in many ways, this symbolism of this struggle can be seen as a tale of the internal duality of the higher spiritual entity subduing and directing and focusing and using the lower passional nature, the solar versus the lunar, or it can be seen literally at another level of the beginning of a new round of individuals coming forth and the struggle between those who were wise in the right-hand path versus those who were equally wise but on a left-hand path.
And we think the contribution was right on point. In so many of the myths that we are studying and that we're familiar with, gods are made men, or there is some definite connection. So we think that that in itself, if we just considered that, if we also know man is made in God's image, et cetera, all of the reminders we have of that point to the fact that there is this indwelling spirit, the warrior who on this plane must battle against everything this life and lives have to offer. But yes, the esoteric being weaved into the myth, as in the symbol and the, all of the wonderful sites that we heard of yesterday, the exoteric always holds within it the esoteric truth, and it is the joy and journey of all students, as we all are, to discover that. Yes.
What is the symbolism with the monkey? Because we did some reading about ancient structures, and it said that there was the monkey image was in a lot of them. So do we know what that is?
Yeah, if you you can check out Isis. It's volume 2, pages 278 and 279. It says that the learned Brahmins of India never understood the allegory of the famous war between men, giants, and monkeys otherwise than in the light of the transformation of the species. So there's a couple of different ways that they could have been seeing that. They're echoing the knowledge that trapped in those particular forms is an aspect of humanity from earlier origination, that man engendered that form and once used it. There's also a message that no matter how solar or spiritually centered a human being is, and this was the flaw that Rama had to overcome, the lower kingdoms, no matter what their form, elephant, monkey, you know, whatever, are to be honored and respected and not tortured or not mutilated or disrespected in some way as less, but rather that all of us hold within an essence that's at oneness.
Echoed in the dog at the end of the Mahabharata, yeah. Being in the arms mm-hmm. of the one and not being willing to overlook or deny mm-hmm. that. Your hand was up.
Can we also look at this idea of gods becoming men in the breaking of a vow, where Dhyan Chohans can fall and have to incarnate and drink to the last drop the bitter taste of karma? So can we look at it from that perspective?
Absolutely. That fall of the exalted ones, the angels, the Dhyan Chohans, in every system we think, the fall, just using those terms, is recognized and in a sense revered for its symbolism that we are but a moment away from that ourselves, that every choice we make leads to that eventual exaltation or fall, and that we believe in most of the systems there is always a way to redeem oneself as well. So yes, the fall we think would be a very important theme to consider.
Mm-hmm. The other thing that comes to mind is in the Mahabharata, when he's standing at the gates of this paradise that he's earned for himself, we see the story of the Nemanakaya, don't we? The one who has earned all rights to total enlightenment and total bliss at the highest spiritual level for that particular round and experience, but yet turns away from that personal salvation to follow the Kuan Yin pledge. Different culture, but the same lesson for all of us. Yes.
Isn't the monkey sometimes used as an allegory, as in the monkey mind, that which plays tricks on us, and the mind is not under control, and we get into trouble because we kind of just let it go? It's kind of passivity.
Mm-hmm. Sure, that's the other way to read this, that the monkey can be symbolized as those lower aspects of personality and lower applications of passion and our ability of lower mind to become entangled in the cares of daily life and being a distractor from what the eternal knows is the true emphasis of life. And in the pages of the Ramayana, what's happening is there's two monkeys that are struggling together. They happen to be brothers, Sugriva and Vali. And the lesser of the two brothers approaches Rama and says, "This guy's going to kill me. This can't happen. This isn't right." And then he goes back into the forest again. And sure enough, the squabbling, which turns out to be over Rama's wife, with Vali saying to his brother, "Don't speak like that about the princess. This isn't right." So Vali's actually the energetic little flying monkey who's defending Rama's wife's reputation. Well, Rama's mindlessness in the moment, he loses focus. He feels he's empathized for Sugriva, who looks like he's getting life beaten out of him. And from ambush, without knowing all the details, he follows his heart's empathy for the lesser of the two, not knowing what's really going on, and he lets fly an arrow, and he fatally injures Vali, who's actually Rama's protector. And in that, we see in a couple of beautiful little pages what detachment from action is. In the latest English translation, which again is not the original Sanskrit, it says, "With his ebbing strength, Vali held the arrow close to his eyes." He's dying and he's trying to, you know, what happened? Where'd this arrow come from? "And spelt the name Rama engraved on it. Vali looked at the name on the arrow and almost was blinded with shock. The shock of the physical injury was not so agonizing as the spiritual shock of reading the name of Rama on the arrow. He looked at it and brooded over his own recklessness in castigating his wife for mentioning Rama's name. That poor creature showed better judgment than he." And then he questions Rama, the lord of culture, breeding, discrimination, and justice. "How could you do this? You've destroyed the firm basis of your own virtues. Is it because of the separation from your wife that you've lost all sense of fairness and act recklessly?" And ultimately, the little monkey, as he's dying, comes to the view of, "But I've been sacrificed by the Lord. My death will bring a tremendous lesson for one who's so much greater than I." And at that point, Rama comes out of the forest, realizes what he's done. He just hasn't knocked this guy over, but he's killed him. And then finds out what the argument was and becomes very, very humbled at what he's done and what he should not have done. So even in this tale of this battle, of this epic hero, this solar king, there's still a potential for learning. And it's at the sacrifice of the life of the lower, ostensibly the lower, where we see mind, Manas, needing to be very, very careful about reasoning from the correct premise to the right conclusion, and not just acting willy-nilly from what we think is intuition, but which indeed may be personal instinct.
as you're saying solar gods, it's reminding me of a couple of things in the Mahabharata. At two points, once in the Gita and once before that, Krishna reveals himself to be what he truly is to those that have earned the right to see it and be in his presence. And he is described as lightning and fire and such a brightness that Brahma, Vishnu, and Shiva issue forth, and just all references to light and fire. And then we forgot there's a part where in the forest, Arjuna and Krishna agree to assist a hungry Brahmin. There is one who is suffering who asks for help. The Brahmin reveals himself to be Agni, the god of fire. The god of fire wants to consume the forest, which is protected by Indra's reign, the one of the gods. And Agni rewards Krishna with his discus and Arjuna with a bow. With the bow and the arrows, Arjuna is able to shoot enough arrows to form a canopy over the forest to protect it from destruction. So the lesson being with the solar gods and the lightning and the fire, never will we be able to extinguish that fire. And if we look at that fire and the solar gods as the spiritual sun we heard yesterday within each and all of us, it's the allusion to the fact that no matter what forces are coming or what may be the intention of our karma, our duty, and those around us acting with us, there will always be the ability to protect that inner fire, that spiritual essence that we are, if we are aware of it and acting in the right manner. So there's a crossover there as well.
And we all know about earth, wind, and fire being symbols, and water, for ancient and modern cultures. The other thing that just came to mind, that Hanuman, who was the lead monkey, the general of the flying monkeys in the army, was said to be the son of Vaya, the god of the wind and air, and a virtuous she-devil. So there we have the origin of the species of the apes, with the notion of air and the possibility of wind and everything we know about being able to fly and bring messages, where Hanuman, although in ape form, is following a creed that's based on ethics and righteousness and valor. And although he is born of a she-devil, it is said, he's following the highest he can within the condition that he is. And again, we see there the promise that eventually such a one might lead lives that lead to enlightenment from the aspect of the fire of wisdom. But he can fly over the waters of wisdom as well.
Yes.
We were thinking as you were speaking about that symbol being carried through. What about in the story of the Wizard of Oz? The Wicked
Wizard of Oz.
Monkey Army. So we're thinking there might be a lot of ways these have been carried down, but unless you have the certain keys, it's just another story.
The other image that came to mind, as you said, Wizard of Oz and the Monkey Army, for those of us that have seen Avatar, and we're thinking of the indigenous people on that planet, they are at once humanoid, but when you think about how they travel through the trees, they're very monkey-like, aren't they? Yeah.
I think Frank L. Baum, who wrote The Wizard of Oz, was a theosophist.
Yes. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah.
So maybe that reference of the monkeys somehow comes from there.
There is a.
That's an allegorical story. Yeah.
There's a local student who could make available a lot of material on the theosophical roots of symbolism in The Wizard of Oz, and we can help you acquire that if you'd like.
Oh, that's okay. When I lived in Chicago,
there's plenty of
all over.
Okay. And so we're surrounded by these ancient structures. We are imbued with these stories from childhood forward of reminders and reminders and reminders, the symbol and myth that continues to try to help us awaken. And being in the Kali Yuga, we remain mired in the muck, as it were. So if we remember that the lotus grows with its roots in the mud and eventually reaches to the air, to the sunlight, we can aspire to that. But these stories are fascinating, and they the oral tradition certainly, and we're fortunate now to have it in written form and able to pass them on in many, many formats. And it is an invitation to do just that. We think children would have a fascinating time with these stories. Yes, in the back.
And in connection with that too, there are probably many avenues that these truths are always brought forth, but we need to really start to question and look at what we were also thinking of. And the moral to the story is Aesop's fables.
Yeah.
These are all dealing with the truth in the idea and the balance of what a moral nature should be.
Absolutely. The moral to the story, we remember that phrase as a child, and the moral of the story is, boy, if we just took a day, the moral of today's story is what? What did I prove? What did I use? How did it affect? What is the moral of what I did today and what I will do tomorrow? There was a hand before you. Yes.
To go back to the to the gods of Yanchuan's the fall, I think there's another side to that concept, which is that intentionally they take on human form.
Absolutely.
They disguise, and that's the other side.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
I mean, that's different from the fall.
Yes, the fall.
And you pointed out in your descriptions that the disguised Krishna disguised as a child.
Absolutely. And aren't we all Krishna disguised as the person, the job, the figure, the look, whatever it is, all of those accoutrements we have acquired over time. But yes, the fall, the other side to the fall is the willingness, taking on the dharma, the struggle in matter, all of it, which is the life's journey. Absolutely.
I thought the end, when you described the dog, who was...
Yes, taking on that, yes.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. Anything? Your hand was up.
This is just a comment. You hear the term life is a classroom. And every day, that half hour should be a time to ponder the moral of the story within ourselves.
Definitely. You know, just rolling along and letting things unfold and getting into routines becomes passive, becomes mindless. The clock is set for the same time every morning. We probably awaken just a minute before it goes off. We rely on these tendencies that we're building for future lives if we are mindless about them. If we awaken with the idea that I am a soul, a spark of that divinity, we are working together towards the full realization of who and what we are within. Just a moment or two, and as was said, at that time of daily meditation, an attempt at a conscious realization of this changes and adds to the whole tone of that day and over time, the lifetime. Mm-hmm. And it is the duty. That's part of our duty in this struggle.
Mm-hmm. The other thing that comes to mind with daily meditation is that in addition to the evening meditation where we review the events of the day and try to learn a better use of motive and morals, we're also invited to a moment of clear seeing in the morning where we do a morning meditation to set a tone for the day. And that kind of took me back to the archery symbolism and another article by William Q. Judge, which you can find in the occult world. he was writing about a different Ramayana. This one is called a Bhushanda Ramayana that he wrote about in 1885. And it was also from an ancient Aryan source. It was said to be an inquiry of religion and science, and a story in which that Ramayana is seeking the true laws of harmony. Bhushanda is a crow. And what tickled me was that the Lascaux Caves pictures yesterday, where the human being has a bird head. Well, Mr. Judge was writing about this Bhushanda, who was a crow atop a sacred mountain, who knew all things from the beginning of time and had dwelt in all parts of the universe. The Chinese and Japanese, using the Bhushanda Ramayana, say that it's Mount Fujiyama, which is the mountain. The Hindus, using the same Ramayana, say it's their mountain of light. But in essence, that Bhushanda atop the mountain is the sixth principle, the nous, the permanent spiritual entity of which we are a ray, that self-conscious enlightenment of which we are a ray. So if we take the Bhushanda idea of this bird atop a mountain as the sun comes up, being many symbols of the eternal and the spiritual, and we couple that with the archery symbols in the Ramayana and the Mahabharata, and we think about the one-pointedness, where the entire physical body has to be stilled and tensed and moved in a very methodical, mindful manner. And so all the corporeal senses are totally under control, the body's under total control, and then the arrow is let fly. That's sort of like what we should be doing in the morning. You know, as the very wise one atop the mountain, whether we envision that in a bird that can fly everywhere and see everything and be wherever they want to and land in the water and land on the physical substance and fly through the air, spirit taking that morning meditation is like the archer. One-pointedness, getting very, very ready, and then setting a tone to follow for the entire day.
And we'll just repeat what a student shared with us that's in Magazine Theosophy, and we'll get you the reference if you'd like, that we use in the morning as a beginning thought. I am a fragment of the all-pervading deity, entombed in the flesh and working out through slow and painful progress its evolution toward reunion and reunification with the One. And it's just the statement or the idea that we are about to fly into our day, into the lifetime. And what are we creating for that lifetime's meditation? And any thought like that, we love the idea of the bird about to soar. Anything like that, that helps us attune all the instruments under our control and then step into the world. Your hand was up.
Flew away.
Okay. It'll fly back, we're sure. Yes.
What about the Buddha's teachings? And also, I think it's a Light on the Path where it says be all thought, and the Buddha speaks of emptiness as you go throughout your day. What about those positions?
We love the idea, the question about the Buddhist thought of the emptiness. We love the idea that the bowl that was carried by the student was meant to remain empty, because if it was full, you could not add anything to it. And we think it's the same idea. If we empty ourselves of the false ideas we hold, if we empty ourselves of our previously held notions of what was true that no longer fit, if we empty ourselves of our selfish wants and needs, we become in essence that vessel, that container for the universe to fill up with what is needed for others. We allow ourselves to invite and answer whatever the need is for another.
Mm-hmm. And that is not to say that we clear our minds in a passive means, or to open ourselves passively in a mediumistic way at all. The process of emptying that bowl is akin to taking a closed fist and thinking, wait a minute, what am I doing? What am I trying to hold on to from fear or fright? Or what am I about to fight because anger is easier to express than fear? And why wouldn't I proceed through life with an open hand? I can receive the graces of life and the blessings of the kindnesses of others, and I can offer a helping hand to others, an empty, open hand of comfort to another who might need it. I can therefore be ready to give. That process of consideration, the difference between a closed fist and an open hand, thinking about that empties the mind of all the physical passions and the lower attachments, but it's a conscious, mindful, under control, attuning of mind. It's an active meditation so that the palm may open, the bowl may empty, but it's under control and it's with wisdom. It is not mediumistic.
We think it's what would be true detachment. And remember, in the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna offers all of this to Arjuna, and Arjuna says, okay, wait, tell me it again. Help me understand. Yeah. I'm not sure I understand. So there is the constant reminding of this as our duty. Your hand is up.
We were thinking about an idea in the voice of the silence, which tells us that the path is one, but it varies with the pilgrim. And there are some pilgrims whose situations are so terrible from the beginning to wherever they plan to go that they cannot observe all of these beautiful things that you say we should do and that and other, because the other side of life is always very busy. So it would seem to us that patience is very important when going through these very serious problems, and we cannot follow the same pattern that everyone else is following. We have to find one of our own.
Absolutely.
Absolutely.
We think patience is key. In a society that runs, doesn't walk, but runs through everything, towards everything, away from everything, that stillness of patience, we think, is a huge key to understanding this. And as we find one with a tremendous load, karmically, we know that that is a very strong soul. Because as we clear up one set of karmic circumstances, we have built muscles for the next to enter, and it is invariably more difficult because we're suited for it now. So as we see the lifetime of struggle and difficulty, and we all know people who are going through things that we can't imagine, we can appreciate that that soul is doing the difficult work of its karma, as we will at some point encounter things of that type. But it is the patience to know This is the lifetime's journey, the pilgrim's path.
And in that patient devotion must also be gratitude. I mean, here we are this morning with things in print, in black and white, in vernacular languages, hundreds of thousands of years after the original lessons were given in symbol and glyph and in oral traditions. Because in those conditions as souls, that's all we had available. That was the best the condition could offer. And yet that impress of all these stories bubbles up naturally in whatever is the medium and the message at a particular time. And aren't we so fortunate that in just one weekend we could see things on screens, we could hear things being said in a variety of melodic accents from around the world, let alone up and down the East Coast, but we also have it in black and white, so that no matter how we best learn or take in information, it's available to us only if we can gift it for others.
And we're just about out of time. We wanted to remind everyone We're no longer selling tapes of the meetings, offering tapes, because we have a newly designed website that offers these, that's what this microphone system is about, that offers digital recordings for free. You need to visit the website, same address, www.ultphiladelphia.org. We think that's correct.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, thanks.
Yesterday's
will be offered on DVD form. That will be available, yes.
And some of the programs you just mentioned?
Yes. The classes here are being digitally recorded and loaded onto the system. It may take a couple of weeks to do so, but there are some on there now, so avail yourself of that.
And it's my understanding that a month at a time will be on one disc.
Yep. But meeting adjourned.
Yeah.
It was fun. It was fun. It's always fun. Look at all the tissues I used to be when I got up. My nose won't stop running. And the other thing I was thinking,
yikes.
We've got to get better shape.
I sounded like yesterday.
Oh, thanks.
That was so heavy, so beautiful you did. I was just so proud.
Absolutely.
And you really gave your heart, and I could feel it. It was so beautiful.
Thank
the way
you
gave that, it was just marvelous.
Thank you.
And I learned a lot.
Thank you.
Absolutely. We need to get better chairs up here. I'm always afraid when I sat in this, it kind of went,
well, right before I sat down, I realized
it's
in deep trouble. And I thought,
this
oh my gosh.
This one, too, the center of it is falling down. Who's going to finish that? But go ahead.
Okay, here, finish.
It's okay.
I'll let you finish.
Thanks. Wizard of Oz.
Did we push whatever we're supposed to push on
the
turn it off on the side?
Something on the side to off.
The side D.